You might want to, before you put it on, put it on airplane mode.
I did. Okay. So, now we're beginning now the Mor Nevuchim. And, you know, it's a very funny thing. Here you have, undoubtedly, the most influential work of Jewish philosophy ever written. I mean, there's really no comparison. I mean, Kuzari is certainly influential, but there's nothing quite like it. Both in its influence in Jewish history, as well as its influence in the broader world of general philosophy. One could argue, the first thing that's interesting is that its continued influence today has very much weakened. Okay? Either that or it's been totally absorbed. I mean, it's like Shakespeare. You know, somebody reads Shakespeare and they say, ah, there's a bunch of cliches. Right? In other words, because all the lines have become so popular. Right? So, in some ways, the Rambam's idea is so absorbed that, like, we're just used to it. And in other ways, it's sort of been neglected. And if you ask yourself a very simple question, who learns the Mor Nevuchim today?
Academics.
So the answer is, in the universities, everyone learns it, right? There is the book of Jewish philosophy learned. Tons upon tons of articles and svarim are written about the Mor Nevuchim. Whereas, in the Olam Yeshivot, right, who reads the Mor Nevuchim? Say, how many do we have up there, you know? Say, a couple, or how many copies of Shari Tshuva we have? Like 50. How many copies of Mesillat Yesharim? How many copies of the Kuzari? Right? And if you'd ask me, what's the more influential sefer today of Jewish philosophy? What's the most influential sefer of Jewish philosophy today? Certainly in Israel, the answer to that question is the Kuzari. Now, there are a lot of reasons for that. Now, the simplest reason is that the Kuzari is a lot more accessible text to read. It's just, and that's part of the point of him saying, because it's sort of this anti-Aristotelian work, even before there's actually a Jewish Aristotelian work, which we'll discuss momentarily. It's not the same type of, not anti-Aristotelian, but it has a certain type of anti-philosophical orientation, and it's just written in a manner that's much more accessible to the masses. Now, whether the masses always understand the Kuzari correctly or not is a different matter. But at the basic level, it's just a very accessible work. Okay. Now, it's true there are parts of it where more complex argumentation, and there are parts of it where it gets into some mystical concepts and all sorts of things. But by and large, you can pick up a Kuzari any given age of intellectual development. Whether you're 16 or you're 16, you can find somebody interested in it, and they're fairly accessible. Okay. And that's one reason. The second reason is that, quite frankly, the Mor Nevuchim was controversial historically. And even though the Rambam, you know, Moshe, in other words, we're now knowing everyone's talking about Yosef and Yosef, you know, Moran and Moran. See how that plays out historically. But in any case, it's a distinct question. But Moshe, it's true, right? That's actually true. Meaning, how many figures were there like the Rambam historically might be? But let's remember, they burned his books. Mamish, like, Pshuto Mashuah, they burned them, they banned them. And any book that has a certain amount of controversial history to it, you know, always it makes people a little bit suspect. You might be aware of the fact that Rav Yaakov Emden even went so far as to say the Rambam wrote the Mishnah Torah. It cannot be he wrote such a book like this. Okay? And the Maimonidean controversy, as it's known, while it has certainly not the same as it once was in the heydays, right, has never really gone away. In other words, it's always been seen as a book with suspicion. So point number one is the Rambam is complex. Point number two is that it's, you know, it has this controversy on it. And I think most importantly, point number three, whether people are aware of it or not, but the reason why people want to learn it is because it is a dangerous work. It's not just that it's controversial, but that's because people are amaratzim and don't understand it. It's that if you actually do understand the book, you will see that it in fact is a dangerous work. Right? Which, as we will see, was dangerous then, and the Rambam is very much aware of just how dangerous it is. Okay? And we will see, as I argue as well, that today also has dangerous implications for it. And if it's not necessarily the Rambam's ideas per se, then it's his methodology that's alarming. And if it's not his methodology, then it's all sorts of various other snippets or whatever it might be in the work that throw people for a loop. Let's just put it that way. Now, that's not to say that the Rambam's work is the most controversial work or dangerous work out there, right, in the history of Jewish philosophy. I know there are definitely many more, there are definitely books and ideas that were more controversial. The Ralbag, Yosemite, so to speak, right, has certain controversial ideas, certainly, and in some ways he's following the footsteps of the Rambam. There are other more clear Maimonidean thinkers who are uber-rationalists, if you will, who certainly had controversial things to say. But this is the Rambam. Right? In other words, I was hearing some academics' presentation this past Friday, and the guy was discussing a certain sefer called Maise Nissim by a certain French writer in the 14th century, and which has been out of print basically for hundreds of years, has now been put together back in print, an academic publication with like 600 people own. You know what I'm saying? In other words, no, like, no, there's no influence whatsoever. You know, historically, this is the Mishnah, the Baal Mishnah Torah. Who, by the way, and this is a very interesting question to go along, includes some of these very controversial ideas within the Mishnah Torah as well. Okay? Which is why they also burn Sefer Amada. And just to give you a little snippet, if you read Mor Nebuchadnezzar 171, meaning section 1, chapter 71, he points you to the fact that in his Mishnah Torah, Hilchot Yesodei Torah, Perek Aleph Halacha Vav, he explains the world as if it is continuous. That is to say, as if it, right, was not created, because that works better. He tells you why he does this. Okay? But it's because it works better for various other theological argumentations he wants to make and whatnot. Okay? In the Mishnah Torah. And if you read the Mishnah Torah, and you're sensitive to a philosophical ring to it, you read, oh, hey, wait a minute. What's happening here? We'll get there. I don't want to jump ahead of things. But so, for those reasons, the complexity, the historical controversy, and that fundamentally, the Rambam's work is a dangerous work, people do not read the Mor Nebuchadnezzar. I mean, study it, learn it in a serious manner. And the Olam Yeshiva. Which brings us back to the distinction which we started off this year with, in the first year, which related to the issue of the relationship between what I call Musar, and I call philosophy, right? Those are the three categories, right? And one of the things that we discussed is, you know, the relationship that they feed off of each other. And I mentioned very briefly that, but I want to highlight now, is that one of the interesting phenomena is when you have a situation where it's not a situation where they complement each other, and it's not a situation where they're just separate realms, but you might actually have a phenomenon in which one goal actually contradicts another goal. And in this case, right, the role of philosophy, right, the philosophical argumentation, in some ways goes against, right, the element of what you might call emunah, or Yiras Shamayim, or Avodas Hashem, Shmirat HaMitzvot, right, that type of goal. Okay? So in one form or another. Now, you can say, wait a minute, the Rambam doesn't believe? Of course the Rambam believes, right? But in yet, what the Rambam himself knows very well, and tells us in this introduction very clearly, is I want you to know that this book is dangerous, and therefore, if you're not ready for it, and he's going to tell us what it means to be ready for it, don't read it. Right? Don't read it. And then he goes on to say, and if Lu Yitzur, one of you who is not prepared to read this, reads it, and now thinks, I'm an apikoros, Please be down on the Kav Zchut. Understand, you just misunderstood me. Yeah, we'll see it coming out.
So
he's still coming. 100%. Meaning, he knows very, very well that things he's going to say here are controversial. Meaning, in the sense of the following, in some ways he knows because he knows it's dangerous. So we'll see what you mean by that. And other times, he doesn't think necessarily it is controversial on an objective level, but just in Metziut, it will be taken in controversy. People misunderstand. So, that being the case, right, why does the Rambam write this book? Wouldn't life been so much easier for him? Right? And he just read the Mishnah Torah, Perish Mishnaya, a few letters, he could have seen a few more patients, maybe a few extra bucks, you know, whatever it might be. But what does he need this headache for? Okay? And of course, if you're asking that question, you probably shouldn't be reading the book. Okay, what I mean by that is as follows. As we're going to see here very clearly, the Rambam, the world of philosophical inquiry, for the Rambam, is not one of those things which you can say, you know, listen, I'm going to be from this room, so I don't have time, I'll do a little bit of philosophy, whatever it might be. No. Right, for the Rambam, it is such as a part of the warp and woof. Man, warp and woof, it's part of the ikar of what it means to be a human and a religious person. What those two are the same here, not be, but in both cases, both. For the Rambam, that the thought of not engaging in that inquiry is just impossible. And so, despite the fact that the Rambam knows of the potential controversy, he's going to engage in this project. Now, this is where we begin the reading. And you see here, right, in the dedication here, he says, my knowledge, he quotes the Pasuk, my knowledge goes forth to point out the way, to pave straight its road. Lo, everyone who goes astray in the field of Torah, come and follow its path. The unclean and the fool shall not pass over it. It shall be called way of holiness. Why is the Rambam starting this way? Right? Look at the Pasuk. I mean, he's very clear. You have any Hebrew here? I don't have any Hebrew. Just read it. Read in Hebrew, just so. There is my knowledge here is going to make the road, right? Why do we need this road? Go ahead, yeah. Wait, what do you mean? No. It's interesting here. No, it's interesting. Why does it in the Kapach edition include this here? I don't know what happened here. That's interesting. Why in the Kapach edition does it have this? In any case, I'm not sure that's interesting. Where, even before where you were reading from, right? In other words, my knowledge here is going to lead the path. If you're going to go astray, listen to me. And if you're a fool, don't come down this path. Okay? Right from the declaration from the get-go. Now, he starts off by framing this. And this is sort of the question, because I said to you beforehand, there's a world of philosophical inquiry, okay, which for the Rambam, you know, you can't give up on. But you might argue and say, well, engage in it, but don't write it down. Okay? Meaning, engage in this world of thought, of what he'll call the Yisod HaTorah, or the secrets of Torah in different places, or maybe Pillars of Torah, Secrets of Torah. But keep it oral. Why do you keep it oral? That's right. You can control it. It's going to misinterpret it. It might be. And he tells you the following story. Okay? He has this student, Joseph, son of Yehuda, who he tells as follows. When you came to me having conceived the intention of journeying from the country farthest away in order to read texts under my guidance, I had a high opinion of you because of your strong desire for inquiry, and because of what I observed in your poems of your powerful longing for speculative matters. I mean, you have a natural raw intelligence and endurance. This was the case since your letters of composition and rhyme prose came to me from Alexandria before your grass was put to the test. I said, however, perhaps his longing is stronger than his grass. So maybe perhaps this guy, he wants it, but, you know, he just doesn't have the tools. But then you came to me and you started studying astronomy and then mathematics, and I saw how excellent you were in it, and then we got into the realm of logic, etc. And I saw that you were one worthy to have the secrets of the prophetic books revealed to you. Then I started letting you see certain flashes. Then I started demanding additional knowledge that you should know, right? And all sorts of things. And then what ends up happening? But you had to leave me. And therefore, since we had never finished our project, I'm going to write down this one. Okay? Now, historical figure, now, whoever it might be, what is the Rambam basically setting this up? That's right. Okay? That's right. But what we're going to, as we're going to see momentarily, he's going to explain that in actuality, over time here, that this in general is an evasive knowledge, right? Which wasn't meant to have been taught, but only because of the needs of the time and the geopolitical or other turmoil of the time, therefore I have to write this down. Does that recall to you anything else? Any other work of the Rambam? Yeah, Introduction to Mishnah Torah, right? Where he says, this is what Rabbi Yonasi did, and this is what I'm doing as well. And the Rambam has a similar agenda here as well, as a war, that there's a certain geopolitical need, whatever it might be, in order to ensure that the Sode Torah, Secrets of Torah, are written down. Okay. Now, what is interesting is as follows. If you'd ask you, what is the primary, what people think about, when they think about the question of, what was the Rambam's real contribution to Jewish philosophy? What's the standard answer? What was the challenge that the Rambam was dealing with? Aristotle's already detailed, broadly speaking. Philosophy as opposed to?
Revelation.
Revelation, right? In other words, the conflict of reason and revelation. Revelation being as understood by what the Torah is and the Chazal for that matter, less directly. And reason being the world of philosophy, which is represented by the Greek philosophers, as well as the modern-day Arab or Islamic philosophers. Okay? But keep in mind, the Rambam was heavily, heavily influenced. People always think Aristotle might be, and Plato might be, but Rambam's really influenced most directly, I mean, certainly by Aristotle, of course, but also by the Arabic philosophers of his time, who were also influenced by the Greek philosophers. Al-Farabi is one of the big names, but others as well. It has been noted that the Hakdama to the Shemona Prakit, where the Rambam really gets philosophical there, right, is almost in many places a direct paraphrase or lifting even at some points of works of Al-Farabi. Which shouldn't surprise us, because in his Hakdama to the parish of Shimon, you know, Hakdama to the Shimon of Prakim, the Rambam tells you, by the way, I want you to know that I here am using the works of Greek and Arab philosophers, or philosophers new and old, which is Greek and Arabic, but I'm not going to tell you who they are or when I'm using them, because, you know, I'll throw you off. So, everyone always thinks that what the Rambam is really dealing with is a conflict of reason and revelation, and there's no doubt that's true. We're going to see it coming up right here. Okay. But since I started off by talking about these, you know, secret knowledge, esoteric knowledge, think through for a minute what else might have the Rambam being trying to address. Not just the conflict of reason and revelation, but a second, not equally important, but extremely important agenda, which the Rambam is trying to deal with. And that is as follows. What else is out there right now? Okay, so So we, okay, there's always that tension between halacha and thought, okay? But the world of Jewish philosophy, if you think about it, is not particularly well developed. Right? It's an interesting thing in its own right. The Bible certainly has philosophical portions to it, or portions that relate to philosophical ideas, but certainly not a book of philosophy proper, argumentation. Chazal as well, whether in Agadata or other statements. Definitely have machshavti ideas there, but in terms of directly addressing head-on philosophical ideas, you don't see that there, which is a fascinating phenomenon, given the fact that Chazal, at least earlier, right, lived in time periods when there are many interesting philosophers around, whom they should have had access to. And since there's all sorts of clearly Greek Roman influences on the language of Chazal, on other statements of Chazal, it might be, it is a matter of great interest. Why is there no direct dialogue, more or less, with the world of Greek philosophy and antiquity? Right? Every time you should think about this question, you think, wait a minute, the Rambam's going to say, well, how come Chazal didn't deal with it? Now, the Rambam is going to tell us a little bit, Chazal has some of these ideas, some of this, some of that, but it's just an interesting phenomenon. So, if you were in the Rambam's time, and you wanted to know the great truths of the world, where would you look?
In philosophy, not in religion.
Perhaps. No, well, that's one of the tensions which people, which the Rambam wants to avoid, deal with. He wants to reconcile. Yes. But let's say you're a Jew, and say, okay, you're a Shana Aleph kid, Rebbe, teach me, give me a good book. You have a good book to recommend to me? And what do you send them to? Tanakh? Come on. Now, you have Rav Saadia going, of course, right? Beforehand, right? Which is a certainly influential work, and you have a little bit of other stuff out there. But you don't have that much out there. And while the Rambam certainly polemicizes or deals with in some portions of ideas you find are of Saadia going, it's not his main competitor, so to speak. There's no doubt the broader world of philosophy is what he's competing with. But there's another competitor, namely mysticism.
Kuzari probably takes that.
A little bit, because Kuzari is before it. Yeah, correct. No, I understand. We'll get to momentarily. But mysticism. Oh, so, has mysticism developed? So this is a very, very interesting phenomenon. And the answer is yes. Okay? But not in the way that you we think about it. Because if we think about the classic mystical text, what's the classical mystical text? The Zohar, and following other works of the Zohar, and later on again. Now, the Zohar is only known in the 13th century. It's disseminated in the 13th century. The origins of the Zohar, in the Masorah, there's been a lot of questions. Did Moshe de Leon find it and disseminate it? Or did, as apparently his wife told, Rabbi Yitzchak Me'ako came to visit? Did he write it? Did he have a hand in writing it? Did he, whatever. So there's a long Torah about this issue, which is a relevant point for purposes. But as many historians have noted, the Zohar didn't come from nowhere. Whatever your view of that issue is, right, there is a long mystical tradition out there, which Jews know about, which is either in the Heichalot literature, or alternatively, you might find in the Sefer, what's it called, Sefer Behir, or you might call it in, what's that Sefer called? There's a machloket, whether, Sefer, oh no, what's it called? Blake, huh? Sefer Yetzirah, thank you, Sefer Yetzirah, okay? Well, not the Sefer Behir, Sefer Yetzirah, which is either, was written sometime between the 2nd and 10th centuries. It's a big gap. We know. Right? We know that by the 10th century, people are writing Perushim to it. Okay? But there's no doubt, okay, that there are mystical ideas out there which Jews believe in. And we know that the Rambam knows they believe in it because the Rambam criticizes at certain points. And in many ways, one could argue, say as follows. This is a thesis that's been most clearly expounded upon by some of Professor Menachem Kellner and Professor Nizra in Haifa. And is a book called Maimonides' Confrontation with Mysticism. He's not the first to say this, or maybe, but he's really fleshed it out, a full book, really one very good book. And one of the things he points out is as follows. The Rambam, when he's going to teach us what are the secrets of the Torah, knows very well that there's a competing view for those secrets in the Torah, namely mysticism, for which you have all sorts of interpretations based on the Mesorah and Chagigah of Arba Shenichas Lepardes, which is also in the Heichola literature and all sorts of other literature, wherever it might be, and which the Rambam is going to flip on its head to give a totally rationalistic, explanation. For which, if you don't know that there is a competing theory out there, you don't realize that the Rambam is polemicizing and going against this, right? This whole world of thought. So it's not just the Rambam trying to reconcile reason and revelation. The Rambam is also trying to compete against a conflicting and certainly a competing version, interpretation of what the secret truths of the Torah are. Now, by the way, in the realm of intellectual history, it's very interesting. When do Kabbalistic works start to get written and disseminated? After the Rambam. Why might that be? That's right. One of the theories is that if this was kept as an orally based tradition, right, for many centuries, you can't do that anymore. Why not? You gotta compete. Once you gotta compete, you gotta put your ideas out there. You gotta put your ideas out there, they gotta be written down. And the Kabbalists are not happy about it one bit. And in Jewish history, Jewish thought, it's changed forever. It's a wonderful theory. I think there's a lot of truth to it. And over the year, I want you to be sensitive to the fact the Rambam isn't just interested about reconciling reason and revelation, which is the most explicit, but he's also introduced to it. And the Rambam's not going to tell me, occasionally he'll tell you. But the Rambam is frequently not going to tell you, by the way, I'm interpreting this pasuk, I'm interpreting this concept, or it might be, in a way which is a very well thought out competing theory of Judaism out there. Because today, if I was to write a book on philosophy, I'd be, I'd say, listen, well, the Kabbalists had this orientation, this was this orientation, this is my opinion. The Rambam's not that generous. And occasionally, maybe you'll see, occasionally he quotes various other opinions, there might be. But on this realm, he's not going to be sitting there telling you, I am flipping Maisa Breshi, Maisa Merkava, on its head in ways in which all these mystics out there would be aghast at how I'm interpreting it. He doesn't tell you that. He's got to know it. Okay? So there's this dual agenda, okay, which the Rambam is going to struggle with. And what then now the Rambam has to figure out is, okay, well, how do I go about doing this? Yeah.
If there was this mystical trends and then this battle of the emotions, why did Rambam not want to write it down in the first place? Because it wasn't worth, even though he was against these ideas, it wasn't worth writing a book about it.
Well, who knows the Rambam? Yeah. I mean, the Rambam tells us, I don't want to write a book. But of course, he doesn't write around your book. You know what I'm saying? I don't really want to write the Mishnah Torah. Yeah, actually, I do want to write the Mishnah Torah. You know what I'm saying? I'm not saying in a cynical way, I'm saying, but like, I mean, he does. I mean, obviously that's the thing that's the problem. But what your question leads us to is as follows. If this is the case, what the Rambam's going to struggle with here is, how do I write this book? Okay? And that is what this introduction is about. The introduction is about why I'm writing this book, how I justify writing this book, and what technique I'm going to use, given the fact that why I'm writing this book is not a simple matter. And that's precisely what the Rambam starts with when he gets to the introduction. Okay? So, the Rambam starts off and says as follows. The first purpose of this treatise is to explain the meanings of certain terms occurring in books of prophecy. Okay? Some of these terms are equivocal, Hence, ignorant attributes to them only one, right? Others are derivative terms, etc., etc. Okay? All sorts of terms. Now, what the Rambam is starting off here is very interesting. What's the purpose of this book? Svein Tanach. Okay? Svein Tanach. Certain words that it might be. Very innocuous. And by the way, it's very interesting that the Rambam, well, it seems to be part of his plans, but never writes a Parish, the Tanakh proper. And yet, one could argue that the Rambam is a very important parashah. Right? Because in many ways, the issue which the Rambam is struggling with is parashanut. Now, that's partly true and partly not true. Meaning, it's also, when you just say, I'm just writing a parish, no controversy here, right? That, you know, sort of like, I'm like Rashi. Just can't get firm in the Rashi. Except for maybe Rashi believed the guy had a body. That's different. We'll talk about that next thing. But, you know, I'm just writing a parish. There is a little bit of a subtle statement that he's trying to, like, undermine this, the whole thing. But there's also something which the Rambam is telling you, that there's a struggle with language which he's going to grapple with. And that struggle is in part a matter of how to interpret the Torah historically. It's also a struggle about how to write about God in a contemporary language. Okay? Which, he's going to argue, is the same struggle fundamentally as you have with, you know, in Tanakh. Meaning the same way that Tanakh can be difficult of understanding because it's a problem describing the religious phenomenon God would be in language, so too does anyone writing contemporary works that have a struggle as well. Now, he starts off saying these things. It is not the purpose of this treatise to make its totality understandable to the vulgar. Meaning, I'm not trying to be clear. Okay? I am not trying to make this, if you're not intellectually sophisticated, but look who else. Or to beginners in speculation, or people that know knowledge. Nor to teach those who have not engaged in any study other than the science of the law. I mean the legalistic study of the law. Okay? This is very interesting. It's not just the unsophisticated who doesn't want, who says it's not for, but also who else? The person who just learns halakha.
Eliminating like most of his audience in the introduction, like who's actually reading.
Right? The Rambam, but remember, this is very significant because the Rambam is telling us here, you might be a Gaon in Talmud, Gemara, Shas, but that doesn't mean that you are going to properly understand my book, or this book is meant for you. Because you just care about the legalistic study of the law. But the purpose of this work is to give the science of the law in its true sense. Or rather, its purpose is to give indications to a religious man for whom the validity of our law has become established in his soul and has become actual in his belief. Such a man, being perfect in his religion and character, and having studied the science of philosophers and come to know what they signify, the human intellect having drawn him on and led him to dwell within his province, he must have felt distressed by the externals of the law and the meanings of the above-mentioned equivocal, derivative, or amphibolous terms as he continued to understand them by himself or was made to understand them by others. Who is this book? Someone who is a believer, who has a philosophical wisdom and knowledge and is struggling and saying that these terms in the Torah, stories maybe, are irrational. They do not make sense. And what can you do if you are in such a state? Well, either you can ignore your intellect because you want to hold on to the foundations of the law, it goes on to say, or you should hold on to this foundation of these terms and what they think it means. And then basically saying my religion is unintelligent and non-intellectual. Meaning, the crisis which the Rambam is trying to resolve is a very simple thing. It seems to be a dichotomy or a to binary package here of options. Either I follow my intellect, or I follow revelation, but I cannot follow both.
Your intellect might take you off of your believing.
That's right. That's right. So, if that's the case, just ignore your intellect, or just follow your intellect. But then what will happen to religion? With your religion, but not just your religion, everyone's religion. Because what happens if all the intellectuals walk away from thinking about Torah in an intellectual manner? The Torah won't be intelligent. Okay? And basically, you're stuck. That's who this book is for. Those who are struggling with this issue. And now I want you to tell you a second element. Okay? And this element relates to a second purpose. The explanation of very obscure parables occurring in the books of the prophets, right, in which a person reads this, and if you just read it by its external meaning, the person becomes very overtaken by great perplexity. Okay? But if we explain these parables to him, or if we draw his attention to being parables, he will take the right road and be delivered from this perplexity. This is why I have called this treatise the Guide of the Perplexed. Why are people perplexed? Okay? And the answer is, people are perplexed. You know why? Not because they're reading Kant. Equivalent, right? Not because they're reading Al-Farabi or Aristotle or whatever it might be. But rather why? Because they're reading Tanakh. And if they're reading Tanakh and they have half a brain on them, better yet, a big brain on them, they are perplexed about what it means. The Rambam states, indicates here, and he states later on, the number one text which a person can learn and turn them into an Apikoros is Tanakh. Yeah. It's more or less implicit here, right? But he's going to tell you, right? That's the problem here, right? And part of the reason is that people have read it and they feel compelled for religious conviction to believe in this book, and it turns them into Apikoros. Because since they don't know how to interpret it properly, they end up thinking that the proper religious beliefs are certain things which are in fact heretical, such as we will see, that God has some form of corporeality. Okay. All right. Now, here the Rambam gets into a very interesting dynamic. How long do we have till today, by the way? What time do you want to stop? 14? 14. Okay. So here, and this is what I'm going to leave you to for our thoughts. The Rambam is now going to get into what you will call the politics of this book. And the politics that he's going to describe here is why he needs to write this book in an esoteric manner. Okay? And there are a number of theories of why the Rambam needs to do this. Okay? And he tells you, basically. And now when you read this now, think to yourself, what's the main problem? Is the problem that basically the Rambam has to conceal the truth because otherwise it will lead people astray? Or does the Rambam have to write in an esoteric manner, what he calls chapter headings, a little glimpse, and then a concealing, and a glimpse again? Because either A, the nature of such wisdom is hard to articulate, or B, on an educational level, from a pedagogical perspective, one needs to teach in this way. Because that is the best way of helping a person ultimately come to proper belief. So read this introduction, if you've read it now, reread it again. And ask yourself, What is the Rambam afraid of? Why does he tell us I'm writing this book in chapter headings? Why am I writing this in esoteric manner? And if you're not sure that the Rambam is writing in esoteric manner, so you'll see, even though it's hard to understand, it's not, that the Rambam will tell you there are seven different forms of contradictions that one can find in various works. And mine will have two different types of contradictions, which are never because I was confused. No, no, that happens in Chazal, but not by me. That's one of the reasons why the whole I got it done. That's why people got a little upset at the Rambam over that line. But rather, right, because either I can't tell you, or because that's the best way for me to teach you. Look at what the Rambam is trying to struggle with. Is it that there's a political fear, meaning that people do not become firm? Is it because the nature of theology is that it has to be esoteric? Or is it on a pedagogical level that it has to be esoteric or in a certain way? Ask yourself that question. And along the way, note what he says about Agadata. Okay? And his partial dismissal of it. Note what he says about how to understand Maisa Breshit, i.e., that's allegorical. And that meant to be taken literally. Catchful statement in its own right. And note also what he says about the proper relationship between natural science and divine science. And can a person know what is divine science without natural science? And then also note what he says, what's the purpose of mitzvahs anyway? Now, a lot of these ideas get developed along the way, but already in this introduction, he's telling you why this is a serious book. Why this is a serious book and a complex book and a work that, as opposed to the Mishnah Torah, just for the purpose of comparison, which he tells you, I'm writing the clearest book in the world here. Sure, I can argue with that. He would succeed or not, but never mind. People are intended to be clear. This is not meant to be a clear book. Unless at any point, I tell you, you think at one point, well, you don't understand me, now you don't understand me. But you think I'm a Bikaris, you just misunderstood. Because I'm just not. So stop reading my book.
It's a perfect disclaimer.
Yeah, well, it didn't work. It's not a perfect disclaimer. I mean, you can tell me it's a perfect disclaimer if it worked, but it didn't work. That's why they burned it. Right?
It's amazing. He knew that was coming. He saw
it. Well, when you see what he writes, you'll see why he knew it. But also, when you think about what is the nature, the consequence of his ideas, what that, things get interesting. So, I would like to cover some ground on, the introduction is fascinating. So we're going to take our time, because it's crucial. It's a crucial introduction, understand it. We'll try this up for next Tuesday, I'll be in touch, email at times after that, and then we'll get on
the
corporate.
Is the Tuesday time going to also be 3:30, or could the Tuesday time be earlier time?
Still recording.